You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, in Burlington, Vermont. Today is Monday, June 29th. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Marilyn Taylor McDowell, author of the recent middle grade novel Carolina Harmony. Marilyn Taylor McDowell has been bringing children and books together for more than 25 years, volunteering as a school librarian, a cultural arts chairperson, and a storyteller, and working as a teacher and as the proprietor of a children's bookshop. She lives in North Chittenden, Vermont. Carolina Harmony is her first children's book. When I spoke to Marilyn last week, I first asked how she came to be a writer.
Well, I think I came to be a writer because I was first a reader. And the reason I started to write children's books was because I was reading so many to my children and fell in love with them. And ideas would come. I'd be giving them a bath and I'd think of Bubble Billy. And I would, and you know, just there was just so much there. These stories just formed in my mind and I really wanted to write them down. And so I did. Uh-huh. And they became, you know, fun for my children, and they still remember them. They aren't published, but they still remember them, and it was good practice, and I guess it just started like that.
So you would tell them the stories that occurred to you, or did you actually write them down and illustrate them and put them in a form that your children could read and enjoy that way?
I didn't illustrate them. I wrote them, and then I read the stories aloud.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
How did Carolina Harmony first present herself to you?
In a picture book. Uh-huh. It was a little, just this character, just a little, almost like a little dream. But it kept coming closer to me and closer to me and closer to me. And it took so many years that it's hard to think back. When did it first start? When did it first gel? When did she become real? And it's a hard question because it came slowly, and as I was working on it in little snippets of time before and after work and with my children at home and caring for my mom, and you know, it was it took a long time.
Did you write the text for the picture book?
But it was, you would never see the relation between one and the other.
Right.
I think that what inspired me the most and what really touched my heart the most was a foster girl I knew. When my middle son was in high school, she was in high school, was a foster child. I had a children's bookstore at the time, and she was doing a senior class project, and that project was to write a children's book. So naturally, she asks the bookstore owner if I can help, and I said yes. She came over with this adorable picture book, very little text, but it was about going to a foster home your first night, mm-hmm. and what that's like, and your few articles of clothing are in a green trash bag. The only thing that you have that you can call your own is your pillow. Mm-hmm. So when you lay down at night and in a house full of people you don't know, and all of the shadows are different, and all of the sounds are different, and you're scared, you have your pillow. And I thought, oh, what would that be like? And as I was writing this book, I thought about her a lot. And in fact, I have a book in the mail to her.
But, oh, good, that's great.
But, you know, so I thought about that a lot. You know, what would that be like? You know, I mean, if things happen when you're an adult, you can choose which direction to take. But if you're 10 years old, what are you going to do when mm-hmm. someone says, we're putting you here?
Yeah.
What if you say no?
Right, right. Why don't you describe Carolina Harmony, the book, a little bit for anyone who hasn't read it?
Carolina Harmony is a 10-year-old girl who is trying to find that place to call home. She's lost everything except her faith. And that is what guides her ultimately mm-hmm. to home.
Okay. And she's lost her family early on in an accident.
Yes.
Right, and then there is one family member who takes her in, but then that doesn't work out either.
Auntie Shen, who right. is her surrogate grandma, the best right. grandma any mountain girl could ask for.
You're right.
And she's a wonderful, wonderful character.
Yeah.
I see her in my mind so clearly.
Yeah.
I actually saw a real person who is Auntie Shen. Years and years and years ago, I was camping. We had to in Dingman's Falls, Pennsylvania, and just about every property had sold out to the state, except for this one elderly woman, and we went up to ask her permission to camp on her property. And there she is, standing up there on the porch, a zillion cats all over the place, thin as a rail, her stockings twisted up on her legs with runs, you know, 2 inches wide, and an apron. But you know what, you know, with her hair all disheveled and just, you know, this look about her, there was something about her eyes, something about her face.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I was standing on the ground and looking up at her, it's a face that I've never, ever forgotten. She is absolutely the most beautiful woman I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And that is Auntie Shen.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the mountain grandma in this story.
Now, do you find that most of the characters that you write are based on real people, even if it's not someone you knew very well, but, you know, do you find that that's usually true, or do a lot of them just come straight out of your imagination?
They come out of my imagination, but they start to become human
mm-hmm.
if I can remember someone.
Yeah, okay.
You know, Miss Ruby is someone that it was a very, very quick introduction, but she stayed in my mind because what a sweet, sweet woman. And and some of these antics that this character Russell pulls
right.
Was easy because I grew up with four brothers. So, you know, they could be very, very protective and they could make me cry, so.
Right. When the book opens, quite a lot has already happened to Carolina. And we hear about her present circumstances, and then we kind of back up and learn her history. And I'm curious how you decided when in her timeline to begin telling the story.
Some of what is in the flashback was a lot of history that came in when I was asked to do some rewriting.
Okay.
And so that was directed a little bit by the editor. When I first wrote the story, I had flashbacks. You know, more woven into the entire text.
Okay.
But we, after talking about it and discussing it and thinking about young readers, we wondered if it might be confusing
uh-huh.
to switch like that. Sometimes, a child will put down a book and not pick it up for weeks and weeks or months. And so that could be confusing. And so in the end, I really liked the way it worked out.
Yeah, I thought it was very well managed, because also thinking of young readers, there's some scary stuff that happens to her very early in her story that you don't present right away, and our initial interaction with Carolina is very comforting, and she's in a good place at the beginning of the book. And then as you go to the flashbacks, you see that she's had a really painful time in getting to this comfortable place, which isn't where she ends up ultimately, but anyway, I think that it probably would help a young reader kind of get into her story.
Yes, and I'm glad you said that.
Now then, you also had some italicized recollections woven throughout, things that she's remembering at the very beginning. I thought that was interesting. I'm curious if that's the kind of flashback that you originally had that then you changed in your edits?
No, but I wanted to have a way to let the reader know she thinks a lot about what's already happened.
Mm-hmm.
This is, you know, has happened to her very recently. The story takes place over the course of one summer, and so a lot has happened. And to have, it's almost like a little bit of poetry, but I wanted it to be almost like a memory that mm-hmm. just flashes into your mind and flashes out, but it's something that as you go through your day, you're still thinking about you know, like the images of her mother, the images of her father, the images of her Auntie Shen, her surrogate grandma. I wanted the reader to know that, you know, as she's going through her day, and she could be laughing and having a good time and swimming in the creek, but there is still this memory, this place where she used to belong. You know, so it shows where she came from.
Where she came from, right.
And, you know, I think that, you know, our history, it affects our decision making. Mm-hmm. You know, like, where did you come from? What do you know? What is it that would make you turn left rather than right? You know? Mm-hmm. So I think, so to have that little bit there, I just wanted to ease into that very long flashback.
Right.
And I thought it might be a good way to do it.
Was this story always meant to take place in the 60s? Was that something that you played with at all, or was it always right from the start, 1964, when you saw Carolina in your mind?
I knew she was a mountain girl, and I knew it was important for this story to take place in a rural, isolated area so that there wasn't a whole lot of intervention from the outside at first. You know, I wanted it to be at a time when people just, you know, neighbors took care of each other and mm-hmm. families just, you know, you just kind of blend in with another family, or you know, I just wanted it to be at a time before computers, when kids still played outside all day long.
Right.
And I really liked that rural and that isolated mountains, and I thought, where would that be? I think that a lot of even children today who grow up in a rural area, they can make connections with Carolina. But I knew that the setting had to be at not just in the mountains, but at a time before everyone was leaving, when the mass exodus down to the cities to find work and mm-hmm. things like that. Mm-hmm. So that's why I chose the 60s. And then I started to research. It was fun. Yeah. Because there's such a contrast.
Right.
Such a contrast between what is happening in her mountain community, and then you go down into the city a little bit, and you know, it's Bobby Darin and Sandra Dee. You know, it's just.
I enjoyed that, actually. I enjoyed that when she's in the policeman's car, and she's listening to the music that he's playing and singing, and it's really fun because all of a sudden it's the Beach Boys. I think you have the Beach
and
Boys.
And the British
song.
Invasion.
And the British Invasion. It's like, wow, that feels so different from the last scene when we're up in the mountains.
That contrast was
yes.
a lot of fun to play with.
The descriptions of the natural world are very vivid and very lovely. And I'm curious if you spend a lot of time in the woods doing the same sorts of activities that Carolina does, for example, with her Auntie Shen.
My daughter and I took a camping trip down to North Carolina.
Okay. Specifically in researching
yes,
this book?
Yes, yes. We need to go hiking. We hiked all over, and I took a lot of notes. And we actually sat under rhododendron trees. It was just amazing to me, the mountain laurel, the rhododendron. And just, we went on one hike that was the best hike I think I've ever had in my entire life. I was through so many different landscapes. I was in ferns, and then I was in this deep, deep woods where I felt like I was in the rainforest. The treetops were so high, and the water sounds different in the streams, and it's darker, and it's, and then we were climbing on rocks and laying out in the sun, and just, it was just wonderful.
Yeah.
So I took a lot of that. And I also went another time, my husband and I went down, and we drove all over because I still needed to, I wanted to go to Cherokee and talk to whoever would talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a little bit lucky there. And yeah, so yeah, we'd love to have gone for longer,
right,
and taken more visits, but I did whatever I could.
Now, where are you from?
New Jersey.
Oh, New Jersey. So I'm curious why you chose North Carolina.
You know,
of all the mountains.
That is the number one question that people ask me. there is a connection in my heart to North Carolina, and I do not know where that comes from, but I am curious about my Scots-Irish family.
Oh, okay.
And I wonder sometimes. I was recently at a writer's workshop, and I listened to a man tell a story, and it took place on Taylor Mountain in Virginia, and there was something very, very familiar about this man. I said, Eugene, I think we might be related. I can't tell you exactly why, except that I felt it, and I just went there. But I was very nervous about it. I was hoping that the folks in North Carolina would say, She doesn't know. She's not from here.
Have you heard anything from people?
I read a great review by a very nice Southern man from in the paper was a Wilmington, North Carolina newspaper, and he wrote a great review.
Oh,
and
fantastic.
So I felt great.
Can you talk a little bit about the issue of race in Carolina Harmony? There is definitely a presence there of the racial tensions of the 60s.
I researched that a lot, and I learned so many things that I did not know when I was growing up.
Mm.
And I cried a lot. I think there's that contrast too, you know, I think up in the mountains, you know, Maddie, Carolina's best friend is a dark-skinned girl, okay? So, and there was still, you know, segregation. It doesn't matter what the laws were. I think it took a while before, you know, everyone felt comfortable blending in together, you know? I don't know where all the fear comes from, but boy, oh boy, it sure was there. And I just looking at that contrast, and also, I couldn't write a book in the 60s without mentioning, race and the civil rights movement and, you know, how does she fit into that? And she's a girl that really, a lot like me, can't figure out the sense of it. So, you know, had to put it in.
Yeah, I think that it's a lovely presentation of the issues at hand to put these two girls together as best friends. And to see the world react around them, you know, to see the way that people wouldn't let Carolina move in with that particular family, even though these are all people who share the same mountain and probably have a certain amount of kindness toward each other, but it's very guarded kindness because of their differences.
And it's just the way it was.
Yeah.
But what I love about Carolina is that she looks at Maddie for the very first time, and she makes up her mind that she's gonna make up her own mind. And she saw something deeper. I like that.
Now I'm curious, when you're writing and that sort of situation begins to come together on the page, are you thinking of your readers at that moment? Are you thinking this will be something good for young readers to read about and experience? Or are you just sort of telling the story and letting it go where it will?
Just telling the story and letting it go where it will. And that was, as I'm sitting and writing, and as I was writing this particular book, there were times that I felt like I was touching on something very deep inside me that made me feel vulnerable. And I would tell myself, you know, you don't have any control over anything. You don't know if an editor is going to like this book. You don't know who is going to read it. You don't know, you know, what the market is going to hold. But what you can control is telling the truth. Just tell the truth. Tell the story the way that it's coming out. I just went with the story. I just tell the story. And if, you know, and because it's really up to interpretation. And I really did believe that there was one child that I was writing for. I didn't know who that was, but I just knew she existed, and I just kept going because it was very, very important that she read the book, that she read this story. It was going to matter to her life. And so it was easy for me to let all of the other stuff, like marketing and publishing and editors and all of the those scary things, what will people think, push it aside and just write.
What would you say constitutes a successful ending?
It needs to be a satisfying ending for the reader. When I was growing up, I hated sad endings. But, you know, some of the books I read now, it's okay if there's a sad ending. There's still some sort of resolution. You know, the novel is just a slice in this character's life, and they're going to move on. And there's a whole backstory, you know, that happened. But the novel needs to have some sort of resolution.
Do you think a novel for young readers necessarily needs to have a moral or any sort of educational aspect to it? Or do you think it can be a successful novel even if it's just, you know, a little bit of an escape?
I think the best books that I've read where I feel like even as an adult reader, I've learned something valuable about life. I don't believe that the writer ever intended to present a moral. Right. It just came out in the story with, you know, the characters. You know, if it's a character-driven novel, this character is growing and developing, making right choices, making wrong choices, suffering the consequences of those choices, and it's just part of the story. And so there may be a moral in there, but I think if you try to make a moral, I think that it could turn out to be a very badly written book. Right. I think that it would be perfectly fine if they threw it across the room. Because it'd be sort of like, now, I want you to sit down here. I'm going to explain something to you.
Right. It's like wedging in a lesson.
Oh, boy, I'm getting a lecture.
Right. Mm. Right.
Yes, and don't we all love that?
Yeah. Carolina loves the book Johnny Tremaine, which I loved. And I read that book to my son when he was little. I'm curious if that was a favorite of yours when you were a child or if you discovered it later.
I think I was fourth or fifth grade. I can't remember when. Maybe fifth. And we were all marched down to the library, and we were to pick out a book. And I don't know if it was for history or English or whatever. And, of course, I was talking to all my friends. And the pile on the table was getting lower and lower. And finally, okay, 5 more minutes, and we've got to go. And I didn't have a book. And now the only ones left were the fat ones. The fat ones with very small print. So I picked up Johnny Tremaine because I have to pick something. Well, what a book.
I know, yeah, it's great.
What a book. It was the first book that I read that the writer didn't treat me like a little kid.
Yeah.
There were things happening there. Johnny Tremaine is maimed. He has to, you know, work through such odds, and the characters were real, and it was just, you know, I think in the book it said it blew dust in your face, you know. I really loved that the writer trusted me as a reader and treated me, you know, as this mature reader that I could handle this. And I didn't know what the word formidable was then, you know. It's like, wow, these are big words I have to look up. And I just really, really loved this story. I read it again after I finished Carolina Harmony, because she carries it around there. I just wanted to read it again.
Yeah.
Esther Forbes did a great job.
Yeah.
So that book changed me. It changed what I chose to read after that.
Yeah. And I was going to ask what other books you read as a little girl that you enjoyed.
Well, I have to tell you, I love Nancy Drew.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Yeah. My friend Ginny and I would just rattle off all the titles to each other. She was much better at it than I was.
At one point, Carolina considers how brave people are in books and how difficult it is to be brave in real life. And I loved that moment in that book. First, because it felt true, but also because this is a book, and she is a character in a book, and it kind of removed that distance between the reader and Carolina and made it feel much more like she was a real person to read that and to realize that she thought that it was really hard to be brave in real life.
I'm glad you connected with that.
Carolina runs away. I won't go into too much detail or give too much away, but she runs away more than once to escape unpleasant or frightening circumstances. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the young reader's attraction to the idea of breaking free.
Finding your own way, that is a very brave thing to do, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
She is so much braver than me at that age especially. This took so much gumption. She has a lot of spunk. And it also shows what her life was like with her mother and father. Where did she get the gumption to know that she was worth more than that? And so she just took matters into her own hands, and sometimes she could make quite a mess of things, but you know. She doesn't always do what you want, but she's human.
Can you talk a little bit about creating Russell's character? Or creating characters who present themselves at least in part as sort of bad guys?
Well, I did grow up with four brothers,
right.
And I hung around with different boys when I was growing up who were considered the bad boys. And those bad boys are not really so bad at heart, but they sure do act tough. And Russell is a roughneck, I guess you'd call that in the 60s. You could call him a roughneck. And he's, you know, he has his own set of problems. And I think that, you know, his vulnerabilities are going to be covered up in a way that is much different than Carolina. He definitely is a troublemaker, and he can be very hurtful. And yet, I wanted the reader to see that his life was not so peachy.
Mm-hmm.
And that where he came from, the things that he has known in his history has made him who he is at this point in time when he enters the story.
Mm-hmm.
And so, people are not all good or all bad. You know, I'm really curious what happened to Russell. So we'll have to
see.
Maybe one day there'll be a story and Russell will come back in.
Okay. This is a tiny point, but until I read Carolina Harmony, I had never heard the term haint. Can you talk about what a haint is?
A haint is a lot different than a ghost.
Okay.
A ghost is, now that's real, but a haint, say you're looking at a rock or a tree and you see the eyes, and you see the nose, and you are swear it's staring at you, and maybe it's getting a little bit dark. It's a haint.
Oh, okay.
So that's...
Maybe this would be a good time for you to read from the book.
All right. They've been having so much fun. Mr. Ray was telling stories with hilarious endings, contorting his face into the silliest expressions as he acted out one character after another. She'd gotten to laughing so hard she had to hold her belly. Even Mr. Ray was bending too. All the while, he was teaching her how to drive the tractor. Mr. Ray said it was not too late to turn this hillside into a field of cabbages, and then he went right into a story about a family of cabbage heads. That got Carolina laughing all over again. They made each other hungry talking about spicy cabbage relish and a crock full of sauerkraut. They agreed they would have a plentiful harvest come October. Mr. Ray said it was certain to be hard planting in this field, what with the rise and all, but you had to make the best of what you were given and appreciate the blessing. Carolina figured Mr. Ray to be the most thankful man she'd ever met. He let her hold the steering wheel, and then he showed her how to use the clutch. Her heart swelled with his praise. You're a good learner. Ah, you're a natural. She drove at a slow and even speed, dragging the wooden stone boat over the plowed field. After a while, Mr. Ray hopped down to the ground and let her drive all by herself. Carolina felt on top of the world as she looked down from her perch on the tractor seat, holding that big steering wheel in her hands. Mr. Ray walked alongside in the furrows, picking up rocks in the overturned soil that were bigger than his fist and tossing them up onto the stone boat. She steered the tractor around a large boulder. Mr. Ray began working at dislodging it. As the distance between them grew, she heard him yell, "Drive the length of this row and then stop." Carolina figured she'd show Mr. Ray what a good driver she was. She knew she could turn the tractor around. Why, it would be simple. Didn't he say she wasn't natural? She shifted gears and pressed her foot on the gas, heading up the rise. She heard Mr. Ray holler, and she hollered back, "I can do it!" Then everything went wrong at once. A jerk, a bang, the tractor rising, her hands leaving the steering wheel as if a force was pulling it away from her, and out of the corner of her eye she saw Mr. Ray running as fast as he could. She remembered how strange it was, how at the moment when she flew off the seat, it was as if she was floating in slow motion. First she saw sky, then mountain peaks, then trees and hill and field. She remembered the scream dying in her throat as she saw the underside of the tractor, thinking she was about to be crushed. But before her back hit the dirt, she was caught in his arms, yanked away, just about thrown. She landed with a solid thump and knocked the wind out of her. She lay still, as if she'd been struck deaf and dumb. She remembered staring up at the soil caked between the wide ridges of the tire and seeing a cloud floating in the blue sky above it. Finally, she rose onto her elbows, uncertain whether 10 seconds or an hour had passed. That was when she saw Mr. Ray. His eyes were closed as if he was sleeping, as if he was... No, she wouldn't let herself think that. She crawled across the dirt, quick as a spider. She shook him gently. "Mr. Ray, Mr. Ray, wake up." He made not a sound. He lay still as a stone. "Mr. Ray, Mr. Ray, please wake up." She saw the blood seep through his skin, saw a slow trickle make its way across his forehead. After that, all she remembered was running. Get help! Every other thought in her head moved out of the way.
That's great. Thank you very much. That's early on in the book.
That is early on, just in the first chapter.
Okay. All right. Now, do you know how to drive a tractor, or is that part of your research?
My husband's teaching me how to drive the tractor, but I don't drive it very much. We have a lot of those hills where we are too, and I still am not sure where all the rocks are. And and this is a tractor that is the tripod. And it's tripod tractors, you know, with you have two wheels in the back and those two little wheels right in the front.
Yeah.
Those are so easy to tip over.
Do you mind if I read a short section from the
Sure.
book? This is after Carolina arrives in her foster home. All night long, springs poked up through Carolina's mattress and jabbed in her ribs. She'd finally fallen asleep when an argument broke out in the house next door, and it woke her up as bad as a nightmare. She lay there staring at the ceiling, listening to their voices rise and fall as they pitched into each other. She hugged her mama's pillow and breathed in the scent. She couldn't smell her mama anymore, not even if she closed her eyes and thought hard. It smelled like road dirt. I loved this section, and I think what I loved about it was that you're showing her loneliness and you're showing her fear without saying that that's what she's feeling. It's just all these details about what that room is like and what that moment in her life is like and hearing those noises. And I just thought I'd say that I enjoyed that. And you know, there's a lot of just every sense is represented, you know, the smells and the sounds and the, what she sees. I thought that was really nice. So
thank you.
What is your schedule like when you write? Are you very disciplined about your writing?
I like to write early in the morning, and I love to start at 5 a.m., but I don't always. sometimes it's 6:30, and if I can get started early in the morning, it will be a good writing day. Even if I'm not at my desk, I'll be taking the story in my head wherever I go.
Yeah. You've worked as a school librarian. How has that affected your writing?
I learned what kids love to read And what books stay on the shelf forever, just gathering dust? After my library experience, I went on to open a children's bookstore, okay. And I knew what to order. It just let me know what children really like to read, and so then I tended to gravitate to those books as well to find out why they love to read these books.
What writers have influenced you, either personally or through their works?
Esther Forbes, because she wrote Johnny Tremaine, and thank you very much, Esther, for doing that. I also, some of the books that really touched me deeply were books written by Katherine Patterson, Cynthia Ryland, Patricia McLaughlin. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of writers who are in a critique group down on the Connecticut shoreline. This critique group is run by Kay Kudlitsky, who is a wonderful writer and a wonderful person. And this group of writers is just the most loving, giving, supportive, smart, talented, and now published group of writers.
How long were you a member of that group?
Oh, about 4 years.
Oh, wow. Great. How long were you working on Carolina Harmony?
I would say I worked on it little bit by little bit by little bit for several years. A good year or maybe a year and a half finishing it. And then there was the rewriting and the editing part of it. But I did send it around to some publishers. I couldn't find anyone who would read it, and I was becoming very, very discouraged. And I saw that SCBWI, the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, they have a work in progress grant. And I thought, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained, and it would be a very good exercise. So I put whatever I needed to put together for this grant. Dotted all my I's, crossed all my T's, sent the first manuscript off, and it didn't win the grant, but it was one of 10 finalists.
Oh, fantastic.
And so to get that letter of merit in the mail, it validated everything. It just really said to me, okay, you're on the right track. And so then I still was having a hard time trying to find a publisher that would actually read it. And so I decided to try to get an agent. And I had met three over the years, and so I wrote them letters. And there was one in particular that I had listened to him talk at a short lawn conference, which is part of the critique group I talked about. And I just really, I liked him so much. And he talked about novels that were character driven. And I remember when I listened to him, I thought, I would love to introduce Carolina to him. So many years later, I wrote him a letter and he said, I would love to see the manuscript. So I sent the whole manuscript down and he called me in less than a week and said that he loved it. And so then on we went, and after, you know, wondering if anyone was going to read this, you know, and would anyone enjoy this book, it turned out that it was sold at auction. So more than one publisher actually saw something of value in the manuscript, and
fantastic.
It was, yeah, oh, happy ending.
Yay, we need happy endings in the writing world, definitely. So what are you writing now? What are you working on now?
Right now, the story is called By Rachel's Hands. And Rachel is an indentured servant girl, 1770.
A whole new set of research.
Yes, an indentured servant girl at the Black Horse Inn. And the book is really about freedom. Freedom that is more than riches, more than glory, more than honor. Freedom that she is risking her life for.
Mm-hmm. And how old is she?
12.
12, oh my. Okay.
And this has been a very challenging book to write, and I'm finishing it up. in the home stretch.
What are you reading these days? Do you have time to read?
Yes. Well, I just finished Iron John. It was a book written by Robert Bly some years back.
Right.
What an interesting book. I'm fascinated by the old, old stories, the ancient stories, stories like The Handless Maiden. And so then I read this story, Iron John. Oh, you know, these ancient stories like The Handless Maiden, they tell you a lot about women's initiation and their willingness to go down into the other world. Very different than, you know, the stories of being pulled down into the underworld. And then you read Iron John, it's all about the initiation of young men. This has been, it's been absolutely fascinating.
Mm.
And another book that I'm reading right now, What Makes a Child Lucky, by Gioia Timpanelli. This is an amazing book, and I'm having a lot of fun with it. She's a very wise lady, and she's an engaging storyteller, and she tells stories all over the world. So that is what I'm reading now, and I, you know, there is a stack by my reading chair, and there is a stack by the bed, and there's, you know, I would use up the entire hour if I told you everything that I wanted to get read.
What advice do you have for other writers who occasionally get stuck in their work or have trouble moving forward? Do you have any exercises or activities that you turn to, or what do you tend to do?
This is a good question to ask me, because I am trying to finish the last chapters of this novel that I'm working on, and it's very, very hard. I want to know what's going to happen before I sit down at my desk. But it's not working out like that. I have to sit down and hope and pray and beg the muse to come and play with me today. Because things are revealed as my fingers are on the keyboard. And so my advice to any writers who are getting stuck is to just sit down at your desk, whether it is a keyboard or whether it is an old typewriter, or whether it is pen and paper and you're outside, you know, sitting by on a rock by a stream or in a cafe, whatever, you just have to start. Just put something down. And in that process, something's going to come to you that you never expected. And what I do when I'm very frustrated, like I say, I sit down with the work. Sometimes it helps to read over what I've written the day before, and then I'll just start, it'll just get me going, like, you know, those, like starting that bike pedaling, and then before you know it, you're headed down the hill. Sometimes it might be good to meditate before you sit down. You know, try to clear your head, try to get out all of those voices that say, oh, what do you think you're doing? Get those away and just sit down with the work. Take a long walk and outside, and take a pen and some paper with you, because you just don't know what's going to pop up as you're walking along. And then you'll be dying to get back to your desk. And just be patient. The best advice, be faithful to the work. There's so much mystery in this. How can I know what is bubbling up out of my heart, going into my head, going through my fingers, and here I am writing this story, but how does it touch another? You can tap into something that is within you. We're not all that different. The things that make us human, you know, they are, no matter where you live in the world, you know, you laugh, you cry, you love, you hate, you get angry, you know, feel joy. It's all there. That's just part of being human. So practice, be faithful to the work.
Okay, that's great. Thank you very much for talking with me. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Marilyn Taylor McDowell. Next week, please tune in again to hear an interview with Sue Williams Silverman, author of Because I Remember Terror, Father, I Remember You, Lovesick, One Woman's Journey Through Sexual Addiction, and the recent book on craft, Fearless Confessions, A Writer's Guide to Memoir.
Today's Write the Book prompt was inspired by my guest, Marilyn Taylor McDowell, who says writers should never edit out the truth. Susan Sontag once wrote, "Literature is a form of responsibility to literature itself and to society. A great writer of fiction, by writing truthfully about the society in which she or he lives, cannot help but evoke the better standards of justice and of truthfulness, which we have the right, some would say the duty, to militate for in the necessarily imperfect societies in which we live." As you write this week, try to keep these thoughts present, if loosely, in your mind. What am I examining in my work? And what is the truth of that condition? Don't force a lesson or a moral into your writing, but identify the truth as you believe it exists and maintain it within the work. A copy of this prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3 p.m. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or events for next week's Bookworms calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Stay tuned for more great Radiator music. Cheryl Willoughby and the World of Music are up next. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, in Burlington, Vermont.